Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the Political Center. We have lots of political news to share today, and I'd like to introduce a co-host on the left, Shireen Gourvani.
Hello, and welcome to our listeners.
And co-host on the right, Dan McKay.
Hello, everyone.
Well, you can hear I have a little bit of personality in my voice because we're excited that the primary election has happened, and at least the big news for our state is we've got a Republican gubernatorial candidate in Spencer Cox and his running mate, Deidre Henderson. Wow. And Dan, I'll go to you first, representing the right and the Republican Party. This will go down as one of the most magical campaign stories, I think, in our state's history. A guy from rural Utah, a very young person, a person who has done a lot of it through volunteer work, at least most of the signature gathering that occurred, someone who won the Republican convention and beats out a former governor, an ambassador, a very popular name in our state. And so that's why, Dan, I said, wow, wow, wow.
Well, I just had mixed emotions this whole time during this race. And what I have figured out, Shireen and Natalie and Anthony, is that I am terrible at picking who the next governor should be. Like, I'm terrible at it. And it comes to a fact of, and maybe this, I don't know if you guys are this way at all or not, but I tend to pick like emotionally based on like who I think, you know, who's good and who's awesome and not necessarily think strategically about who's going to win when I think about endorsements and some of those things. And, you know, now I hope that the Cox, team and I can be great friends afterwards, despite not necessarily fully appreciating their campaign as early as I did, but I fully endorse them now. They're great.
But have you heard of Chris Peterson?
Let's hear about Chris Peterson, Shireen. I spent some time with him this week on the phone just because he's interested in tax policy. I got to know Karina Brown a bit. I met her at an event up in Logan. There'll be a policy-oriented substantive team to take on the Cox-Henderson ticket.
That's exactly right. And I could not be more excited about these two individuals, but in particular, the experience that and focus that Chris Peterson would be bringing to this office. With a background in doing some really interesting work, and just a little bit about him personally, he's a fifth generation Utahn, went to high school here out on the west side, ended up getting recruited to Bingham, graduated from there, was the debate champion his senior year, I believe for the state. He is a very thoughtful, kind, and deeply intellectual person when it comes to tackling some of the big problems that we're facing. In particular, he comes with a background of experience fighting bail bonds and work that I think payday lending in particular. So that effort and I think that work is really important when we are looking at what kind of long-term financial crisis we might be facing coming out of COVID-19. So anyway, I hope that every listener will at least go give him a good look and understand a little bit about who he is and what he would bring to the office.
We're down to a Republican and a Democrat in this race, and so we can give more equal time. I'll just add, Dan, and then I want to get a little bit more commentary on the Cox victory. But Karina Brown, I wanted to get to know her a little better. She told me that she's the president of the Friends of the Cache County Children's Justice Center. She's co-chair of the Cache Celebration of Women's Suffrage in 2020, board member of the Logan Regional Hospital, board member of the Cache Valley Chamber of Commerce. This is a Northern Utah person. She's a planning commissioner for the city of Nibley. And interestingly, she's one of five, I believe, citizen sponsors of Prop 3, the expanding Medicaid proposition. So that's what I mean by substance.
Okay.
I'm seeing Dan smile.
So Dan will not be taking a closer look at these candidates, but I would love to hear, Dan, I'd love to hear your feedback on what you did see from the plethora of Republicans that we had running for governor.
Yeah, so I love to do like postmortems after elections, like how, you know, what went wrong and what went right for candidates and where they kind of, I don't know, you know, why the electorate didn't ask them to be governor, right? I look at, you know, man, you know, my running mate, Jeff Birmingham, I think he was a solid business leader. I think Thomas Wright, same thing, solid business leader. But it's interesting, when I looked at the polling from November of 2019, the number one issue for voters in 2019 when looking for a governor or their experience, guess what they're looking for? Outside, fresh perspective, something new, right? Something they haven't seen. In March of 2020, right? The end of March, I guess early April 2020, right before convention, even Republican delegates, but this poll expanded beyond Republican delegates and said, what are you looking for as your number one criteria? Guess what they said?
Experience.
Government experience. And everything else was, it was just swapped upside down. And that just shows you, for Thomas Wright and for Jeff Birmingham, the race just kind of ran away from them with the COVID issues that were going on. And then you look at, you know, I mean, lesser known candidates. I just mentioned Jason Christensen, he's a perennial Republican candidate, and he always does very badly and will continue to do badly. And that's good. I mean, we need somebody to be really bad. Then you look at, you know, the Huntsman campaign, right? They have all the experience. They have the resume. They have all of those things. How can a John Huntsman Jr. lose a race like that? And it's crazy how in Wikipedia, you look at the John Huntsman resume, and it is awesome what he's done. And there's a footnote now on his Wikipedia page. Oh, yeah. He ran again and lost in 2020. And there's a lot of people out there wondering why. And I have some theories, those kinds of things. My feeling is he could never really answer one question, which is, why do you want the job again? You left once and we're down with you leaving, but why do you want the job again? And because he literally could not give an answer that the voters like accepted. I'm not saying he didn't give a good answer. I'm just saying the voters couldn't accept it. And for that reason, they weren't ready to go back and ask, you know, and ask him to do the job.
Dan, I'll
and
add
I guess
on to that.
I look at the Cox campaign and I say, I don't know that I have seen a campaign run on a statewide level that has been better run as far as, you know, looking in hindsight, all the things that they did, even the mistakes that were made in the Cox campaign, they were able to rebound quickly and jump back on message, which I didn't see anyone else do successfully, which is, and I will say this, the only other political person I know in the state who is even close to Spencer McAdams, to Spencer's talent is Ben McAdams. Nobody can get anything to stick to Ben McAdams either. And so you try to go negative, you try to push, you try to fight. They can get everybody to kind of look a different way and really not focus on the negative. That skill is impressive, right, Natalie?
So can I ask, though, I think there's something interesting here, because that desire for experience did not translate into some of the wins that we saw for the congressional races. Now, what that says about Congress, I think, is a whole different conversation. But we have two people that will be, Burgess Owens and, I'm now forgetting, is it Blake Moore?
Blake Moore, first congressional district.
In the first congressional district, not coming to the table with experience in government. I'm kind of curious. I don't know. I'm curious about your perception on that, Natalie.
Well, I would just say that I just think people are different in how they pick governors than how they pick, you know, representatives in Congress. Just my thought. And Dan, I want to just, based on your commentary, when I think of Spencer Cox's campaign, I think of the harder I work, the more luck I have. You know, he started his campaign earlier than anybody by a long shot. That's hard work. It ended up being the perfect decision, or lucky, right? Because COVID came. And I think the history will write that COVID actually served him well. I'm sure he'd like to not have had it happen. But in the end, you know, Wright and, you know, all these other candidates didn't get to get in front of the public. And Spencer Cox had many opportunities to do that. He had Austin Cox run his campaign. Austin's a friend of mine. I think Austin's, you know, in his 20s. I hope I'm right, Austin. I apologize if I'm not. But look at what they did. And now you've got, I think it's, I know that Governor Huntsman will rebound and find something really great to do. I believe he's committed to public service. He'll have many opportunities. He's way too talented. But I also think that we should, those of us on the Republican side, Shereen, should get very excited about a young, imaginative, smart, policy-oriented candidate, Spencer Cox.
Well, and don't forget, I mean, this is not just, I mean, and Spencer is going to be a good governor. I would look just beyond him and see, you can always judge the quality of the people by the people that they surround themselves with. And I look at Senator Deidre Henderson, who is a close friend of mine for years, and she's a phenomenal lawmaker. And if the lieutenant governor's responsibility is to interface with the legislature and do it well, she will probably be the best that I have seen in my short period of time. Nothing against the lieutenant governor, but she has a much longer resume and much greater experience. If we're going to go and say, hey, our next lieutenant governor is going to be the next governor, we could not honestly ask for a better person than Deidre Henderson. So I'm excited. And, it's funny, the number of Coxes involved, you've got Austin Cox on the campaign, you got John Cox, and then you've got Kristen Cox, who works in the governor's office of budget management. That's a lot of Coxes, on the staff and on the team. So it
might be time for a shakeup.
It'd
be nice to have a few different last names in there.
a lot more
to come on the race, and I'm glad, Shereen, that you mentioned the tight race in the first congressional district with Blake Moore and Burgess Owens, coming out of the fourth congressional district. Let's transition in the last couple of minutes we have here in the first segment to talk about this record new high cases in our state, passing the 200 mark and deaths in Utah, and globally, some bad data as well on the coronavirus. Shereen, sobering news today.
It is.
We're recording this on Wednesday, and our state hit this new high.
Yeah, and I just really, I know that there's a lot of unrest and uncertainty out there generally right now. I just really want to take a moment and send my condolences and my thoughts to the families who have lost 200, loved ones, family members, 200 Utahns. Over now, I think it's 201 today. I've just been thinking about that number. Frankly, I think about it every morning when I wake up, and my hearts are with them.
Yeah. Dan, any quick comment on coronavirus before we end this segment?
Well, I put out an op-ed, and I will just add it to the commentary that, look, if I get a lot of people saying, hey, we don't want a government mandate, we don't want this, then we've got to get control of the case number, right? It really is unfortunate. I hear Shereen talk about the first thing she thinks about in the morning is what's our case count for the day. Like that, for a virus that is becoming as ineffective, and the CDC is saying that it is decreasing in its lethality, that we would continually still be stressed about it is interesting from a sociological standpoint. We have got to get this economy revving again. The government cannot continue to borrow to get everybody out. And so in some ways, I know this will sound crazy. You guys will both want to punch me. Luckily, we're distant today. But at some way, I kind of wish we would start getting to a weekly report of the numbers and stop being focused on the daily numbers. But that's probably just me. And people, you got to wear your masks if you want to get school back going in September.
It's a great way to end the program. In our next segment, we'll talk a little bit more about masks. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shereen Garbani and Dan McKay. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shereen Garbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We've been talking about the gubernatorial election, the congressional elections, and even wearing of a mask to prevent the spread of the novel coronavirus. I want to set this up, Dan and Shereen, by just saying that our governor right now is sitting on a pretty major decision he needs to make. He's sitting on a memo from the business community asking for some sort of stronger position on the wearing of masks, particularly in yellow and orange designated areas. He's got, I believe, a letter from the Utah Hospital Association asking for a face covering mandate. I went to the trouble to look at a lot of the research on this, and I'm just going to quickly reference four studies. One that was really clear that COVID-19 is spread through aerosol particles. Another one that was a review of 172 studies across 16 countries and six continents that showed the value of physical distancing and face masks. Another one that talked about the impact of face masks in GDP. This came out from Goldman Sachs. If listeners are interested to that, we can put up the link. But then a fourth one, and Dan, this one will interest you the most. This was by the National Bureau of Economic Research, so it's a very important economic entity in our country, but basically showed that fear of infection, not legal shutdowns, account for the greatest proportion of reduction in economic activity. So just to translate that, it's the hit on confidence that's keeping people from engaging in the economy, not government, the stroke of a pen of government. So the question is, I'll go to you first, Shereen. What should the governor do? And Dan, what should the governor do?
So I will say this. I believe that having this conversation, so the majority of Americans believe that we should be wearing face coverings. They simply do. And a lot of people are doing this. What we also know is that we are in a critical point right now where the decisions that people are making and the fights that we're going to have about this are leading to a decision of whether or not we're able to open our schools this fall, right? So we are at a critical juncture and we have to get this under control. But I'm afraid what we're going to see is continuing basically economic brownouts because we have failed leadership at the top. We do not have a national testing strategy. We do not have enough tests. We are struggling to keep up with tracing in the many states where we're seeing numbers just explode. All of these problems that we have, I think, with true leadership at the top could have been addressed, but we have a failed presidency that's leading to this massive economic uncertainty that's leading states to have to make really difficult decisions. So I don't envy the governor, but I hope that we're moving towards a place as individuals. I know that that's probably going to be right up Dan's alley, but like, you have to wear your masks, get your masks on, and please do not gather in large groups.
Yeah. Dan, I have a sense I know what you're going to say, but would you even go so far as to say let local government leaders and health departments make that decision? That sounds like something Governor Herbert would do.
Okay. I mean, here's the thing. We are going to, with the stimulus package that's currently being considered, we're up to $8 trillion now. We could add another couple trillion and, you know, we'll be in a position of having spent more money on this than we will have on the Great Depression relief and some of the other New Deal proposals. You look at the amount of debt we're proposing in the deal. It's getting bad, right? Or it's bad already. I mean, you think about the fact that we have 500,000 homeless people in the country today. And with 500,000 homeless people in the country today, what do we have? We could have taken that money and with debt financing, we could have funded the construction of over 12 million homes at a $200,000 median home price. So with 500,000 people out of homes and with 12 million homes built, I think we could have solved homelessness. Think about the commitments that we're making as a country to keeping this thing shut down. Now, if confidence is really the issue and you're afraid of spread or that kind of thing, by all means, please do put a mask on because it is the right thing to do. It is the civil solution to making sure that when you interact, you're in great space, right? That's great. But there's still so much we don't know about the virus. We still see lethality dropping through the floor on a regular basis. And everybody wants to make fear like this overarching, you know, issue. And at the end of the day, all I see is the people who need the economy the most. Those who, you know, need to provide for their family, who, you know, whose jobs are affected, impacted, it is the people at the bottom of the economy. And yet they're the ones who are hurt the most in this shutdown. And because of the way we are, the way we're handling this, whether it be mandates, whether it be, you know, mandatory business shutdowns, you know, I was, you know, it, it I just look at all of that and I say, the government is only going to make it worse. We're only going to create more fear. And I don't think people putting masks on it necessarily is going to solve the transmission issue. You know, and as soon as studies are published about the transmission issue, it's going to, you know, stagger things even more. So really what I think is, if you're afraid and you have confidence issues in engaging in the economy, put a mask on. It's what I'm doing on a regular basis, because I'm like you. I am nervous about it. I do not want the COVID virus. I'm out. Like, that's not my thing. That said, I know my family depends on me getting stuff done and being involved. And if yours does too, join me. Put a mask on. Let's get back to work.
I know that just from your body language, Shereen, you wanted to have a little rebuttal there. But I would just say, from the political middle, I like to take the best ideas from the left and the best ideas from the right. I buy Shereen's point that we're at a critical juncture. I think that is absolutely correct. I think that for 3 weeks here, we should try something to get on top of this case count problem. And I would focus on the high positive case count areas, and I would let local government make their choices about what they want to do. That's the political middle. Hey, let's jump to some news that came out this week. I think it's called the Student and Exchange Visitor Program, but it's the guidance about international students. And it's really troubling for those of us. I work for the University of Utah because we are so committed to our international students, and they're such an important part of campus. We're a leading public research university. We're dedicated to global scholarship. We're dedicated to an inclusive and diverse culture, and we welcome and embrace, you know, international students, faculty, and staff from all around the world. And we've got this new guidance that's saying you're not welcome here if you're doing online classes. Shereen?
Yeah, so I think this is another startling reminder that often with this administration, the cruelty is the point. The students that are here who are on these visas may have been on summer break, but are here sometimes for 3 or 4 years as they're completing their degrees. This is deeply unsettling. And it was also after many universities made their decisions about going primarily online. So it was very hard, and it creates a lot of just internal problems for universities to go back to try to address this by recoding many classes or creating some sort of opportunity to keep those students here. If we do not have the kind of America that is welcoming to all anymore, that should be deeply disturbing to all of us. I know that actually there's a really interesting story. A lot of Iranian Americans that are here in Utah came into Logan. They were at the university there in the 70s, became citizens, are huge parts of our communities here in the Salt Lake Valley. And it's, like I said, it's devastating, and I think it's cruel.
Yeah. You want to know what's cruel? No, here's what's cruel. You're here on a student visa, and because their country has shut down immigration or visiting from America, that you can't get home. You want to know? That's what's cruel. So I have two students from Ghana who live in my house right now. And why do they live in my house? Because they can't get home. Ghana has shut down the ability for students to get down, at least currently, right? So the worst thing we could do, you want to know what's cruel? Let's bring them all here, and then their country prevents them from ever going home.
Yeah, what we're talking about, though, are students that are here, that are currently enrolled, that are in mid-process on their degrees.
But see, that's the same point. We have students that are out in the United States who can't get home either. And so there's this big problem where isolation and our own policies are getting in the way on both ends of it. And you want to make it about cruelty. I'm telling you, it's not about cruelty. It's about trying to do like what makes any sense. And as soon as somebody says, hey, let's make some sense and close some things down a little bit with a mandate, you're like, yeah, that's great. But if you want to close down travel from other countries who may have higher infection rates with their students, no, don't close that down.
I can see this is hard for you. For the listeners, we're on a Zoom, and Dan is absolutely melting down over this. But I think there's a really important point here, is that the specificity of individual circumstances make this difficult to navigate. And that's why a ruling like this from ICE is so deeply disturbing to many in the community.
Oh, I thought you were going to say that's why a mandate on masks would be a terrible idea.
Dan, as your meltdown, I think I'm down to him.
Here he goes.
I think I'm down to a minute, and we got to go to your gripes or gratitude. And Dan, we'll go with you first, but it's got to be quick.
There's never enough time in this show to get the truth out there. Just know that.
Shireen?
So I'm going to express my gratitude for Ben McAdams' efforts to try to create more transparency around the PPP loans. What we have seen is that Trump again used it to enrich his friends. And actually, I guess his now rivals, Kanye West, received millions from the PPP loans. So I'm grateful that he was a champion for transparency.
I'm going to do, and it's not that I so much agree with this, but I think it's an important news item for our listeners to know, but the ruling that was a victory for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and Indigenous environmental activists, where they ordered the complete shutdown and emptying of all the oil from the Dakota Access Pipeline. Shireen, I know that's near and dear to you, so I'll just say congratulations.
Thanks. Wearing my shirt today.
You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and Dan McKay. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening, everyone.